Brother Derek read a few verses from Genesis chapter 23, or 32. I did it. chapter 32, a little earlier. And what I want for us to do is I want for us to sit back, and we're going to discuss those verses tonight, eventually. And my remote device is looking for my computer, but can't find it, apparently. But technical difficulties, excuse me for a moment. What I want to do tonight is I want to look at a particular character in the Bible. I want to look at who he is and what he's like. Now, before we get into that, sort of to say some things to sort of set our minds where I want us to get. When I came in this evening, right, before worship service and everything, before we all... Okay, there we go. Now. Okay. All right, here we go. So, before worship service started, when I came in, one of the very first things I said out loud is, don't tell me about the World Cup. Because I like sports. And I like... One of the things that fascinates me about sports is athletes. The different kinds of athletes you see, the different characters that you see. And so after I said, don't tell me about the World Cup, what does Cal do? But scores 1-1. Now, the thing is, I'm not actually upset at Cal because that was the score in his 73rd minute for USA versus Portugal. And I saw up to the 73rd minute. So I know that. That's cool. All right. I don't want any updates from anybody's cell phone. Now, one of the things I like about sports, like I said, I like to look at athletes, look at their character, look at how they behave, because that's fascinating to me. I mean, when you watch soccer, now, this last week, I got to be with a really good friend of mine, Josh Higgins. He preaches just up the road, up 680 in Dublin. He was here last year, right? Yeah. Josh. Really amazing speaker, even more amazing Christian. And Josh has three kids. He's Jackson, and for some reason, his middle son. I hadn't seen him in years, but I talked with Jackson, and Ava's his little girl, that's the youngest. Jackson's 14. Yeah. Teenagers take themselves and everything else way too seriously. And so, of course, I told Jackson soccer puts me to sleep. Because he plays soccer, and his dad's a soccer coach. So, whoa! This really put me to sleep. I was watching the World Cup today, for crying out loud. But I love to tease him. And one of the things I tease Jackson about is soccer is the only sport where you have guys running around at full speed, and all of a sudden, nobody's around them. They're trying to draw a penalty. Nobody actually hit them. And then they look up and they see that they didn't actually draw a yellow card from a ref, and so they get them, they start running at full speed again. Welcome to soccer. The Italians and the Brazilians are the worst at that, by the way. Although the rest of Latin America can also be pretty bad. Soccer fascinates me in particular because you have players who have this cult surrounding them. The fans, soccer fans are the craziest. They're worse than Dodger fans. And you know how Dodger fans are here in San Francisco, right? So, but these soccer players have this cult of personality around them. Now today, USA is playing Portugal. And whether they win or lose or draw determines whether they automatically get past their group or whether they just have a shot to get past their group. I can't wait to see what the result is. Don't tell me no cell phone updates. I have a recording at home. But you have these soccer players who are very braggadocious. Why Cristiano Ronaldo of Portugal, who America is playing today. And then you have soccer players who are entirely different. One of the things I'm always fascinated by is that some of the best in the world don't talk about themselves ever. Now, some just won't shut up about themselves. England has produced a lot of great soccer players. They've produced a lot of great things over the history of the earth. But one of the greatest they've ever produced is David Beckham, who played for the LA Galaxy for a while, as a matter of fact. And the thing about David Beckham is that whenever he opens his mouth, very rarely is it ever actually about him. And I appreciate that about him. And I like that about Beckham as an athlete, is that he doesn't use his fame to make himself more famous. And I want to talk about a character in the Bible who sort of represents both of these extremes in a really fascinating way. And from the text that Derek read, you probably know that we're talking about Jacob. What I want to talk about tonight is the concept of not letting go. There's some good things, and there are some bad things. But I want to look at lessons from the life of Jacob. Oh, it went. Oh, did it? Oh, yes, it did. It went one ahead of me. That's fine. Lessons from the life of Jacob. Jacob starts off his life. I mean, literally, he's grasping his brother's heel, right? Coming out of the womb. Now, that's where he gets his name Yaakov in Hebrew. And the thing about that is it became an idiom that meant someone who is a trickster or a deceiver or a liar. Someone who can't be trusted. Did Jacob live up to this name? Yes. I'm reminded of the tale of Jacob sitting there making stew, cooking, and his brother comes in from the field. Oh, I'm starving. Give me food. Now, was Esau actually starving to death? Probably not. I wonder if they were teenagers. Maybe Esau was being a little melodramatic. A little humor for you there. Now, there's instances in which Jacob says, well, give me your share of our father's inheritance. Give me the double portion. Then I'll give you some food. Now, it's important to point out at this point in Jacob's life that, yes, God had said Jacob would get this in spite of the normal cultural practices. So Jacob was going to get this anyway. But the way he goes about acquiring it for himself is morally deficient, to say the least. And then later on in his life, as his father is old, his father is blind, and he's passing on the family blessing, Jacob disguises himself, goes to his father, and he says, I'm Esau, I'm here for the blessing. Now, Jacob must not have been a good character actor, because apparently he couldn't work with his voice. And so, Isaac says, I feels like Esau, but I hear Jacob. No, it's me, it's Esau. Jacob lies. And God had ordained that he was going to get this blessing, this Abrahamic blessing, passed on to him. But again, the way he goes about achieving it for himself is, once again, morally deficient. Then, of course, does Esau get a little mad? Just a little. As a matter of fact, what does he says he's going to kill Jacob. He's furious. I'm going to kill that liar, that thief who stole what was mine. And so Jacob runs away. And the fascinating thing to me is that as he's running away, he lays down to sleep for the night, and God gives him a vision. And after this vision, after this dream of this staircase or this ladder, we all know the dream, right? So we won't read it and rehash it over again. I'm not going to have a whole lot of text on my presentation tonight because there's just way too much to deal with, because we're going to pretty much be dealing with Jacob's entire lifespan as it's recorded in the Scripture. So too much to deal with. But in chapter 28, turn there if you would. This to me is fascinating. He's in the middle of this dream, and he sees this staircase leading into heaven. And behold, the Lord stood above it and said, this is verse 13, I am the Lord, the God of Abraham, your father, and the God of Isaac. And the land on which you lie, I will give to you and your offspring. Your offspring shall be like the dust of the earth, and you shall spread abroad to the west, and to the east, and to the north, and to the south. And in you and your offspring shall all of the families of the earth be blessed. Behold, I am with you, and I will keep you wherever you go, and I will bring you back to this land, for I will not leave you until I have done what I have promised you. And so then Jacob awoke from his sleep, and he said, surely the Lord is in this place, and I did not know it. And he was afraid, and he said, how awesome is this place? This is none other than the house of God, and this is the gate of heaven. So he called the name of that place Bethel, or Bet-El, which means house of God. Here's the fascinating thing to me, is that right after there in verse 20, Jacob makes a vow. Here's the thing. Jacob has just gotten a vision from God, where God has promised, I'm going to be with you. And then he says, if God will be with me and will keep me in this way that I will go, and if he will give me bread to eat and clothing to wear so that I once again come to my father's house in peace, then the Lord shall be my God. I find this stupefying. If God will do all these things for you, then I'll call you my God. And this stone, which I have set up for a pillar, shall be God's house, and all that you give me, I will give a full tenth to you. So Jacob receives a vision, is promised by God protection and providence and safety, and then he says, prove it. Which to me, I don't know. It just doesn't really sit well with me. It doesn't really sit well with me. And a lot of the rest of Jacob's life becomes a study in what goes around comes around. Jacob lied, Jacob cheated, Jacob stole. So what happens to Jacob when he gets to his uncle's place? Well, his uncle lies, his uncle cheats, and his uncle steals from him. There you go. You reap what you sow. And this, to me, is fascinating. Because Jacob's life, at the beginning, for the first several decades, is defined by one singular trait. People who lie, people who cheat, people who steal, people who insist on that others prove themselves to them before having any dealings with them in the first place, have one central character trait that defines them. Oh, I have lost my connection. Oops. It didn't happen this morning. Okay, we're connected again. The character trait that defines them is arrogance. There we go. We're back on track. Arrogance. Can you see where I was going with the World Cup now? Soccer players, athletes in general. We got some basketball fans in the house. There's a basketball player, good, but who has dubbed himself King James. You know who I'm talking about? LeBron. Now he's good. But it takes a colossal amount of arrogance to do that, doesn't it? And this, what gets me about Jacob's story, the arc of Jacob's life, what really helps me as a child of God is looking at the end. Because the ending to me is absolutely fascinating. Everybody turn from chapter 28 to chapter 48. 20 chapters into the future of Jacob's life. Jacob's almost dead. So we've gone from young Jacob, arrogant. Teens, 20s, we don't know. We don't really know. Lying, stealing, cheating, deceiving, not caring, not trusting God, to a Jacob who is no longer arrogant, who's something a little different now. See, now Jacob is the old blind man. And Jacob is passing on this family blessing again now to his son. all of them except one. One son doesn't get it. Joseph. Instead of passing this to Joseph, Jacob gives it to Joseph's two sons. He skips. He goes to Ephraim and Manasseh. Now, the really fascinating thing to me is that Jacob has learned a few things. How many people think you're smarter than your parents? Come on, you're 18. Raise your hand. I'm sorry, man. I'm just picking on you. Hey, if you don't think that, good for you. You're already ahead of the game. Jacob, smarter than Joseph. Because if there's anything that we learn as we get older, it's that for better or for worse, sometimes for much worse, we end up, unfortunately, to most of us, becoming like our parents, don't we? And Jacob sees himself a little bit in Joseph. And he also sees his father Isaac in Joseph. Because if there's one thing that this family has shared in common from generation to generation, it's the problem of having a favorite son, isn't it? How many children did Abraham have? Question mark, we don't know. But we know that he loved Isaac more than all the others. How many sons did Isaac have? Two. And he loved Esau more than he loved Jacob. Where's Rebekah, the wife, the mom, loved Jacob more than she loved Esau. Jacob had 12 sons. And he loved Joseph more than he loved the other 11. And there's a lot that happened because of that. And so now here's Joseph. And he's got two sons. Ephraim and Manasseh. And Joseph loves one more than he loves the other. And as Jacob, who is now being called Israel, is sitting down, and they're sitting on his knees, and Joseph is bringing them before them to pass on this blessing. They come forward. And Jacob, who's blind. Now, culturally, the right hand was the dominant or the greater hand. Never understood that. Left-handed people are always better, right? I shouldn't have said that. That's not really true. We might be better thinkers like Leonardo da Vinci or Einstein, but that's beside the point. The right hand is the greater hand. And so the greater blessing is passed on through the right hand. So Manasseh is the oldest. And that's Joseph's favorite. Ephraim is the younger. And so Jacob takes his right hand and he puts it on top of Ephraim's head. And he takes his left hand and he puts it on top of Manasseh's head. And Joseph says, "No, Dad, you have it backwards." And Israel's response is, "No, Joseph, you have it backwards, because this is what God has chosen." This is a man who is completely changed, who has emptied himself of his desires, of his wants, of his priorities, and in place of what he wanted to do with his life, he has injected what God wants him to do with his life. He is now, on his deathbed, a man who is, instead of being arrogant, a man who displays humility in his life. So what changed? What changed? And this, to me, is the great part about the life of Jacob. It's because you look at this whole span and you notice some things about Jacob that are actually, hopefully, they're true about all of us. Because all of us sort of live our life from youth to old age, right? And there seem to be two personalities warring within us. As a matter of fact, the Apostle Paul kind of talks about this a little bit. He talks about the personality, the part of himself that submits to the will of the flesh, to the will of sin. That sin reigns through that part of his psyche, that there's a part of himself that is always tempted to do what makes him feel good. Lust of the flesh, the lust of the eyes, and the pride of life. And this is something we all struggle against. That is the self that is defined by arrogance. Because sin is all about me. What's true in the life of Jacob, and hopefully it's true of the rest of us, is that as we get older, the self that is defined by arrogance diminishes. And the self that is defined by humility increases. And this is what happened with Jacob. And so for me, the question I want to ask tonight, and what I want for us to spend the rest of our night contemplating and looking at this transformation and why it happened, is where's the turning point? Where is this point of intersection? Where do these lines meet, and how do we change from being one into the other? This is where we come back to our scripture reading tonight. Go back, if you would, to Genesis chapter 32. Chapter 32. Jacob has left his father-in-law Laban under somewhat dire circumstances. He had to flee for his life. And there was a mishap involving idolatry and stealing of the family idols that he didn't even know about that affected his favorite wife, Rachel. So there's problems in the family already. So Jacob went on his way. This is verse 1 of chapter 32. And the angels of God met him. And when Jacob saw them, he said, "This is God's camp." And so he called the place, the name of that place, Mahanaim. And then Jacob sent messengers before him to Esau, his brother, in the land of Seir, the country of Edom, instructing them, "Thus you shall say to my lord Esau, thus says your servant Jacob, I have sojourned with Laban and stayed until now. I have oxen, donkeys, flocks, male servants, female servants. And I have sent to tell my lord in order that I may find favor in your sight." And then the messengers returned to Jacob, saying, "We came to your brother Esau, and he is coming to meet you, and there are 400 men with him." Uh-oh. "Why do you bring 400 men?" Jacob's assumption is, he's going to kill me. He's still mad. It was years and years and years ago. 21, to be exact. 2 decades plus 1 year had passed. And here's the thing. Jacob still thinks Esau is mad. What does that tell you about Jacob? This is what the thing that I like to do sometimes. Dig into actual human psychology, how it works, and how the characters of the Bible display it in a very interesting and profound fashion. What we tend to do is we tend to project ourselves onto other people. We assume that they function like we function. We assume that they think the way that we think, right? And the fact that we do share so many things in common as human beings is how we can relate to one another in the first place. So to a certain degree, a lot of that's true. But here you have Jacob saying, he's still mad at me, he wants to kill me, which tells us a little bit about how Jacob's mind still works. Jacob, if he were in Esau's place, would probably still want to kill his brother. So Jacob hasn't crossed that threshold, has he? Not yet. This is what's fascinating to me. So, the, Then Jacob was afraid and greatly distressed, and he divided the people who were with him, the flocks and the herds and camels, into two camps, thinking, if Esau comes to one camp and attacks it, then the other camp that is left will be safe. And then Jacob said, O God of my father Abraham and God of my father Isaac, O Lord who said to me, return to your country and to your kindred that I may do you good. I am not worthy of the least of all these the steadfast love and the faithfulness that you have shown to your servant. For with only my staff I crossed this Jordan, and now I have become two camps. So please deliver me from the hand of my brother, from the hand of Esau, for I fear him that he may come and attack me, the mothers with the children. But you said, I will surely do you good and make your offspring as the sand of the sea, which cannot be numbered for multitude. So, all right, it looks like Jacob is praying for deliverance. There's nothing wrong with that. But look at the way he does it. Remember, you said, remember, maybe it's me, but I see a little bit of that going on here. That Jacob still hasn't learned to trust. So he stays there that night. And then he sends a gift onto his brother ahead. And then he sends his family. He's encamped on the side of a river. And then he sends his family and all his possessions, and he sends them all to the other side of the river, and then he stays on the safe side of the river. He has put his wives and his sons and his daughter, don't forget Dinah, in danger. And he kept himself safe. So he still hasn't hit this turning point yet, has he? He stays there alone that night, and then something happens. Jacob was left alone, verse 24. And a man wrestled with him until the breaking of the day. The interesting thing to me is that we often assume it's an angel. Not so sure. When the man saw that he did not prevail against Jacob, he touched his hip socket, and Jacob's hip was put out of joint as he wrestled with him. And then he said, let me go, for the day has broken. That's where we get to our scripture reading. Let me go. It's dawn. We fought long enough. But Jacob said, I will not let you. Why in the world does Jacob say this? I will not let you go until you bless me. What in the world is going on in Jacob's mind? We got to dig into this a little bit. This seems to be important, doesn't it? So, here we are. Jacob, this man, struggling, wrestling all night long. Anybody ever been in a wrestling match? An actual competitive wrestling match? I'm not talking about jumping off on top from the top of the couch onto your little brother. Oh, that never happened to me, no. An actual, honest, competitive wrestling match. Okay, Derek's nodding his head. Did you wrestle in high school? No, okay. So, I was never on the wrestling team, but I sometimes would engage in friendly competition with guys who were. I have never been more tired after 3 minutes of my entire life. My entire body, all the muscles in my entire body are just ready to just give up. You reach the point. 3 minutes, that's all it takes. You reach the point of fatigue everywhere. That's just 3 minutes. All night long. And nobody gets the upper hand. And this is what I find to be interesting. And I wonder why. Because if we read a little further on, Jacob makes some assumptions about who this is, and I think those assumptions are correct. But I think this is allowed to happen for a purpose. What is God interested in with us? Relationship, right? God is interested in building relationships with His people. So here you have Jacob, a man that is trying to build a relationship with God, that God is trying to build a relationship with, but Jacob keeps letting his ego get in the way. So put yourself in the mind of Jacob for a second. Here you are, someone comes, and you think he's someone sent by your brother to attack you, so of course you defend yourself. And it goes on all night long, grappling, wrestling, throwing to the ground, locks, pins, hold, all the stuff I love to do with martial arts. All night long. And you still haven't won, and he still hasn't won. And then, pop. And this word isn't touch, it's a strike. He's struck on the hip, and is dislocated. I've never had a ball and socket joint dislocated, but I hear that it hurts. Just a little bit. The hip more so than others. Because you can't move that whole leg. Which means you're hopping around on one leg. And so here's Jacob hopping around on one leg, latching on to this person, this being, saying, bless me. Because this man lets this fight go on all night long. And then at the end, teaches Jacob a lesson in power. Teaches Jacob a lesson in power. You think you can win, but you can't. Because when you fight against me, everyone who does that loses. And I let it go on all night to show you that's all it takes. Just one hit. I think Jacob understood right away it could have been over at the very beginning. And that's why he latches on and says, bless me. And then he says, what is your name, Jacob? You shall no longer be called Jacob, but Israel. He who strives with God. This is fascinating because there's a way in which this name could be a good thing, and there's a way in which this name could be a bad thing. And for the rest of his life, Jacob lives up to the good aspect of this name. And for the rest of their history, Israel lives down to the bad aspect of this name. The nation as a whole. Did they struggle with God? All the time. But what God says to Jacob, and I think this is God manifesting himself in some human enough form to allow this interaction between himself and Jacob. He says, you have striven with God and you have prevailed. Wait a minute. I thought Jacob lost. I mean, isn't that what typically tends to happen when your hip comes out of its socket and you can't fight anymore? That's called a defeat. In every arena of competition I know, Jacob lost. So why in the world is it said that he prevailed? Because in our relationship with God, winning and losing has nothing to do with the physical. Winning and losing is all about what happens up here and in here. You have striven with God and with men and you have prevailed. And then Jacob said, please tell me your name, knowing what it already is. And then this man says to him, why is it that you ask my name? And there he blessed him. And so Jacob called the name of that place Peniel, which means the face of God, saying, for I have seen God face to face, and yet my life was delivered. Jacob did win. Because Jacob
finally understood who and what God is.
I want for us to notice something about Jacob and what goes on. By the way, if you haven't figured it out, this line where these two lifestyles intersect, that's this night. That's this night here in Exodus or in Genesis chapter 32. That point of intersection where the arrogant self becomes less dominant and the humble God-serving self becomes more dominant is when we meet God. Maybe it doesn't happen necessarily physically like Jacob did, but it's when we meet God, when we finally understand who and what God is, and then we decide to do something about it. That's that dot for all of us. Because after this, before this, Jacob had sent his family ahead, right? And he kept himself behind. He was using them as human shields to protect himself. And then in the morning, he crosses the river and he goes to the front. And he goes to his brother and he kneels in humble submission, saying, "Forgive me, I have done you wrong. If you want anything of me, take it." Esau says, "All I want's a hug. That's all I want. Because God's given me enough already." And then for the rest of his life, for the most part, barring his relationship with Joseph, which we know was quite disastrous, but for the most part, for the rest of his life, he tried to do what God wanted him to do. And I like looking at the lives of people like this because it helps me understand my walk better. And hopefully it helps us all understand ourselves and each other better. That if you'll notice one thing I did with this chart, the arrogant self, it never really goes away, does it? Still always kind of there. It does never actually get to this line. We die sometimes before it hits that.